I said to somebody, you know, doing these shows, there is constant anxiety about deadlines. But we have such license to meet these people. It's like we get these amazing gift baskets every month and open it up and there's more and more and more and more.
Maybe we should give each other people for Christmas.
Yeah. Well, actually, Columbus Day is coming up. That's kind of tacky in some circles, but, you know, it's the spirit of discovery. Why not give a friend the gift of introducing him or her to another friend? Discovery doesn't have to involve enslavement and stealing land. That is not strictly necessary.
And, in fact, the next story came from that kind of friend-of-a-friend introduction. This is Blake Moore.
Havana, miles from my nascent memories of fruit gatherers gaping at the folded woman. The piles of children giggling, crowding in on her, attempting forward bends and back arches before somersaulting into the delta. The strangers greeting her with namaste.
Blake Moore lives in a tiny town on the Northern California coast. She's 38, she does performance art, and she works teaching poetry in the schools and other things that come along. We'd been introduced by a mutual friend, and I looked at her website, which sounded like it was about five different people. So we invited her, in her multiplicity, to talk.
When I think about the path that I've taken, I mean, ultimately the whole point of all of my journeys have been to understand my spiritual connection. And then it seems like the line has never been straight. It's circled around and come back in and spiraled in deeper. I'm seeing now, as I get older, that there's no real completion to anything. It just keeps deepening. I was going to be a lawyer. Yeah, I was student body president. And I really wanted to go into politics. I wanted to change the world. And I grew up in a Republican family. And I actually was on the Reagan-Bush advance team when I was 18. And then when I was in my mid-20s or early 20s in college, I spent 3 months in Washington, D.C. working for Pete Wilson in his press office. I was a press intern. And I really experienced how the system was not really working for the people. And I watched it. I grew up in Los Angeles and I went to school at UCLA, so I kind of experienced Hollywood. And suddenly I was experiencing Hollywood in Washington, D.C. and seeing the smoke and the mirrors kind of behind the wizard. And I realized this isn't the way that I'm going to be the most effective. I moved to London because I was going to go to the London School of Economics. And I had a sexual harassment interview where I had some middle-aged British businessmen ask me a very inappropriate question. You know, we're asking, there's three men, and we were in a conference room, and blah, 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 normal questions. And then finally the guy says, "Do you like yourself?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I like myself." And he says, "Do you like yourself enough to masturbate in front of a mirror?" That's a grossly inappropriate question. What's that have to do with investment banking? I don't think a whole lot. And I just said, "Yeah, do you?" I think they wanted me to respond emotionally and run out of the room, you know, and then they told me, you know, they left me a message to call about the job. And when I called, I remember being on the payphone and hearing that I was given the job, and I was just like, "Oh no, what am I going to do?" And then I just waited and thought about it for a couple of days and decided no. And I really didn't have any money, and I was in debt, college loans and all that kind of stuff, and I became a waitress. I got lucky because I ended up working in Covent Gardens, and I'd take home 60 pounds a night. Like, my whole freedom opened up. I realized I didn't have to sit in a cubicle. I didn't have to push numbers. This wasn't really what I was going to have more of an effect touching people. I mean, I look back at all the things that have happened to me, both good and bad. Perfect timing. Well, that's where the Middle East came. I saved up enough money, and then it actually drove from England all the way down to the tip of Egypt with an outfitter called Adventure Overland, I think, and there were 10 of us in a lorry truck camping the whole way. The story that I've told a lot was in Egypt, and it was in a camel market. And I'm wandering around, and I was covered, and a young kid, I'd say he was probably 14, 15, he saw me, and right at that moment he was slaughtering a camel. He cut the leg off and cut the vein, and blood is dripping all off the leg, and he puts it up to his mouth, and he starts drinking the blood, and the blood's dripping down his chin, down into his chest, and he's staring. His eyes are locked in mine while he's doing this. I'm just like, whoa, what is he doing? You know, and I just held the gaze, and my feeling, what he was threatening me in kind of a challenge, like, you want to watch us? You want to see what we're doing here? Let me show you. You know, it was kind of barbaric in its challenge and its audacity, but there was a deep embodiment that went with it, that I took it as a crazy wisdom, and it shifted me profoundly. I was no longer this kind of naive tourist. I felt like it was a bit of an initiation. I came back to Los Angeles, and I got engaged to my college sweetheart, and he asked me to marry him on his graduation day, and so, but we didn't make it, he and I, and we went different ways, and he wanted to get a Volvo and a dog and a sailboat and a house. And when I met him, I loved the wild man who turned me on to acid and who was just a nutcase who read tons of books. And suddenly he was turning into what he thought was the right thing to be if you're going to be a husband. You know, he was going his way and I was going mine, and we crossed. I feel like he was a doorway for me. He opened me up in a way that, I don't know, he helped me get out of politics. I rub your hands into mine, tell you I'm not the one to take you from Cuba, and speak of resources beyond possession, the mortal magic I have found on your streets. Old men on the Malacron crooning Hotel California across from a rusting Yamaya altar, all more alive than any TV screen, any backroom broadcast.
And from there, well, she lived in Japan, London, Amsterdam, traveled in France, Morocco, Mexico, the Philippines, Cuba. It would take some time to sort through all the stories. We talked about one recent trip that kind of encapsulates them all.
The Laughing Squid trip to New York City. It was put together by John Law and Scott Beal, and Laughing Squid is a web hosting and email linking site, networking site for the underground art scene, Bay Area. And so John actually is in the middle of he's got a book that he's writing about the scene. He's got a New York publisher and an editor. And so he and Scott cooked up the idea of, hey, why don't we bring San Francisco and this kind of wild underground to New York? So we were actually doing kind of an off-the-cuff documentary oddity roadside attraction film while we took these three doggy diner heads. Oh, they're 10-foot dachshund heads. The first San Francisco kind of Bay Area fast food chain started in the early 40s, and they lasted till about the mid 80s. And they pretty much, you know, regional fast food chain, and they were put out of business by McDonald's and Burger King and all the big chains, the national chains that came in. So they kind of became a symbol of the underground. And so we had this bus that belongs to Jericho Reese of the Bicycle Rodeo. So we had bikes all piled on top that, of course, turn into Ferris wheels and merry-go-rounds and teeter-totters and these kind of like those zipper, I don't know, the two that go up. It's wonderful, crazy kind of punk oddity machines, big, you know, crazy clowns. That with the three dog heads and 14 performance artists. And we did web uploads the whole time. So we were chronicling our journey, and it was being filmed. I mean, we're all performance artists, so our life is guerrilla performance. I mean, there's no way we could not be a spectacle, from, you know, people in outrageous costumes to just outspoken, creative individuals. And we'd stop someplace at truck stops, and me and another person, the cameraman, he and I would just, we both had tons of energy, and we were pinned up on this bus. So we'd get out, and we'd run around the parking lot. I'd be doing cartwheels everywhere, and then I'd jump up on something and start doing kind of crazy contortion or doing yoga something. So it was fun to go into a world that I'm not normally part of and really play. And there was enough of us that play was allowed. Well, the best reaction probably was in Memphis when we did this Easter Sunday and did a funny improv show at the Piggly Wiggly in Memphis. A lot of people didn't even get out of their cars. They circled us like chum. You know, we had one guy, I think he circled maybe 20 times. And this guy pulls up and cracks a beer and leans out the window and says, what are you all doing? And we kind of say, well, you know, we're taking these dog heads to New York City. And we tell him what they represent and why we're going and what we're doing. And he's like, I used to live in California. my life was good then. And he takes another swig of his beer and looks at us, and he kind of like started to break down. And it's Easter Sunday, you know, and he starts to, in Memphis, he starts to kind of break down. And someone says, well, you know, he's like, I feel like you guys are a sign. You know, my marriage isn't working. You know, my kids are gone. I'm unhappy. I don't know what to do. And he goes, and here you show up from California. You know, and so basically we had this thing, this ritual we do with people where they had to touch all three dog noses for luck. So we're like, well, why don't you go touch all three dog noses and, you know, something might happen. So he goes over and he, not only does he touch them, but he rubs them and then puts his third eye on each nose and kind of says a little, you can feel him saying a little prayer and then going from one and going from the next to the other. My ode to Campos, cacao. To compañeros offering irrefutable life, open ojos and never-ending conga lines in exchange for promises.
And now she gets down to the city, but the day-to-day life is in a town of 440, and by no means are they all performance artists.
I would say that's probably why I said in the last, say, 6-7 years I've been happier than ever. But I would say living where I live has allowed me the luxury to be part of a very small community, and a community of mirrors that are able to tell me how I'm affecting people. And I've learned that in my life as a performance artist, I leave a bit of a wake behind me. You know, I'm like, boom, speedboat, moving through, going, yeah, here we are. And sometimes, you know, people don't want their toes run over by a skateboard. And so I'm learning now how to better read when it's appropriate and not be selfish in my freedom or my self-expression, and still be honest. And really, I still strive for, I believe that it's great to kind of push the edges of people's thoughts and their boundaries. But if you do it too far, they tighten and clench. So I don't want anyone to tighten and clench. I just want to be able to open doors and say, hey, it's not so bad in here. Walk through. You'll like it. You know, but when you live in a small town, you're going to see each other at the post office, at the grocery store, at every party, you know, and it's small. All the travel that I've done, I think, has really helped me to be tolerant and to be open of different ways of life. And it's shown me, like, the palette of possibilities. I've learned that, like, I know this is funny, I stopped myself, but I'm going to tell you the truth. I at home, I have created a compost outhouse toilet because I don't like going inside. I like to be outside when I wake up in the morning. And I spent a year and a half on some bare property where I dug a hole every morning, rain or shine. And, you know, there's nothing worse than the middle of winter, totally naked, digging a hole because you got to go to the bathroom, you know, and you got to dig that hole fast and it's raining on you. And it's like, but it taught me kind of a level of survival. And I didn't have to do that. You know, I was my extremist. You know, I go for that to really understand and penetrate that truth. And in some countries, that's normal. In this country, it's crazy. And I got to learn not to think of it as crazy because of my experience in other countries and go, you know, I'm acting out my primal essence right here. And I'm connecting with the earth in the deepest, really in the most compostable way you can. You know, I'm making soil. And so why not be like the leaves and the duff in the forest and really understand this? So, you know, travel has given me that freedom and my flexibility in my mind. When I come back and I integrate. And sometimes it can get heavy because when I go home, you know, I've got responsibilities at home. And I've managed to convince, let's say, the schools and the different people I work with that this works. Like, this is okay. You know, it's all right to let me go away for 3 months and come back and work for a month and then go away again. It works. And so I think when I come back, this time has been incredible. And I came back with this kind of something profoundly shifted. It's going to be what it's going to be. I can think I control it, but more and more I know I don't. And as soon as I get in any kind of control, then I lose control because then I get all tight and my body hurts and something funny happens. So it's really me surrendering and taking that, feeling the ordinary as very extraordinary. You know, that I feel like, wow, I've already lived so many lives in my 37. that, you know, I could die today and go, wow, yes, God, you know, whatever you think God is, and just go there. But I know that's not, I mean, I'm here for a reason, and I just must keep being, you know, it's important to me.
Merely believing that this husbandless creature could survive at the Boca de Rio de Mil, at the mouth of the river of honey, alone, standing on her hands so she could leave footprints on the sky.
We were talking with Blake Moore. You can visit Blake's multifaceted website at www.snakelyone.com.
Artists' journeys. Now, there is a really admirable courage involved in following impulses, whether it's improvising a scene on stage or hitching a bus to Nairobi.
Or L.A.
But we have to balance this a bit now, because we always believe that courage is admirable, and yet...
However, sometimes artistic daring is just plain dumb, as we found in our own 10 minutes of stardom.
Milwaukee, 1972. An amazing opportunity. Our theater has been asked to perform on the main stage at Summerfest, a huge Milwaukee festival featuring rock concerts and beer and jazz and beer and polkas and folk dances and carnival rides and beer. But the main stage, 10, 20,000 people, is big stuff.
Freddie called.
One of the guys in our theater has a rock band, and their manager is booking the Summerfest main stage. They're doing a 50s rock revival show, and they need to fill 10 minutes. The two big acts, they've got different band setups they need to fill while they change the setup because they might have a problem with crowd control. So they thought, hey, Theater X, they do guerrilla theater and big puppets and comedy. They'd be perfect. Oh, God, we'd have to do a whole new piece for it.
He said they'd pay $300.
Oh. Now, $300 doesn't sound like much, but it was a lot of money to us in 1972, not to mention the potential.
Oh, man, it's going to be a lot of publicity. Think about the number of people that are going to be there, and the papers are going to be there. This is something that's going to really put us on
style,
there.
A really physical style, you know, really broad and just kind of clown-like, and, you know, because there's so many things we can
and
do.
This is about economic manipulation and all that kind of thing. This is really showing the underside of what they're coming to
popular
see. I think this gives us a real political voice.
And we had some qualms, but it was kind of a calling, a chance for us to really make an impact, and $300. And I wrote The Creation of a Rock Star. It was really a broad farce with an acrobatic clown and sleazy music industry types and a deadpan college professor, me, a bunch of groupies, a mad scientist, and a 10-foot rock star puppet with Elizabeth inside sitting on the shoulders of a 6-foot ex-marine. It was big, wild, funny.
And yet a serious critique of the co-opting of art by corporate America.
And as a politically progressive theater.
Believing in the power of laughter to bridge gaps between people.
We actually felt we could make an impact on 10,000 kids blasted on beer and pharmaceuticals. So we rehearsed, and Freddie's manager thought it was great, and finally we were ushered in backstage between the armed guards, kind of wondering if this might be our big break.
As a politically progressive experimental theater.
Believing in the power of laughter.
And blind faith.
No, we might have had a chance.
You're dreaming.
But we were between Chuck Berry and Little Richard.
This is nuts.
And we were dead meat.
Huh? Oh, I can, yeah. Yeah, you didn't save for the concert, did you? No, actually, it didn't. Have you ever heard Chuck Berry live? I mean, 3 encores, they were on their feet, I mean, screaming. They wanted him to sing forever. And finally, he splits, and this crowd is fierce. And the MC comes out, they start booing him, throwing stuff at him, and he's on there long enough to say, "Here they are, Theater X." And we're on. I'm on the mic. I can't even hear myself. I mean, it is one solid wall of audible rage.
We are not really what's wanted right now.
There's stuff coming up on stage, beer cans, rocks, and the first immediate impulse from everybody is, let's go. But, you know, then something took over. I don't have professional pride or wanting to make sure we earned that damn $300 or maybe just wanting to say to those bastards, you're going to see this whether you want to or not. We kept going, Yeah.
10 minutes is a very long time.
We kept going. We did the whole thing. You know, Rick had to be taken to the hospital for stitches. Everybody got hit by stuff except Elizabeth, who was inside the puppet's head, and then little Richard came on and tore the place apart. I mean, he had him crawling up over the electric fence in front of the stage. Later, they broke up folding chairs and built bonfires.
Well, that was 30 years ago. And actually, we did what we were hired for. We kept up the energy of the crowd. And something came out of that. Courage, solidarity, and understanding of limits. Well, a year later, we were looking for chairs for our new storefront theater. Almost no money, opening night, a week away, somebody told us about a warehouse full of busted chairs. We might find 100 good ones for $1 apiece. And we did. They were the artifacts of our journey into the big time, the chairs of Summerfest. Our theater had its seats.
You're listening to Hitchhiking Off the Map.